7 council people present, so I'm going to call this meeting to order. This is the Economic Development Subcommittee meeting, Tuesday, November 19th at 1:30. My name's Janet Kilpatrick, co-chair of this committee. Taking the minutes is Nellie Hill. Present are council persons Sheldon, Weiner, Hollins, Smiley, Cartier, Diller, and Rudd.
Brain freeze.
Whoa.
That's a terrible thing to waste.
It sure is. It's partially gone, you know?
That war just took a step backwards.
Originally, the first thing on our agenda was to be the president of the state chamber, and yesterday morning we got an email that said for unforeseen circumstances she would not be able to attend this meeting. A little later in the day, we got a notice that she had resigned from the chamber.
Nice picture.
I guess we now know why she isn't coming. That's why she's not coming. That is. So, you know, we tried three times to get her in here to talk about who she was, introduce herself, because I felt like from an economic development side that would have been a very nice thing to have, you know, some knowledge of what the president thought coming out of the state chamber. So I guess now when we get a new president, we'll invite him or her, and hopefully that will go better than the last one did.
It only takes you to drive him out.
I need a
motion to approve the minutes.
Second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
So we will skip to number 3, which is Marcus Henry, and he's going to just give us an update on the economic development plan for Newcastle County, with a reminder that Thursday at 9 is the kickoff.
Yes, Thursday at 9 o'clock. Marcus Henry, Policy Director. Really just my purpose and update is, you know, one, to thank council again for approving the purchase order last month for our economic development plan. Wiley Dobbin Growth Tech is the consultant that we hired. Their start date was actually November 1st. They're going to be engaged for 6 months to do this study. We're excited about the study, obviously. We've been talking with a lot of the stakeholders. But we're having this kickoff meeting on Thursday to invite all the stakeholders. The council has been invited to this event. It's Thursday at 9 o'clock at the Gilliam Building. Refreshments will be served, and it's really to get everybody's input, buy-in, understanding that this is a collaborative process, working with all these stakeholders so we have a good plan moving forward. And, you know, can answer any of the questions other than that.
I'm sorry, I guess I wasn't zoned out for a second. What group is meeting at 9? And
well, we invited a bunch of different constituencies to come to this meeting on Thursday. See if I have a list of folks.
It's a kickoff to
economic
development proposals.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It includes business leaders, labor, academia, government, obviously, and civic organizations who will be a part of this study in terms of focus groups to get their input and insight on economic development issues and action steps for how the county can move this forward in the near future. We felt it's very important as a kickoff to get as much buy-in as possible on the front end for this study.
And is I
have some follow-up questions, but go right ahead.
This is going to be run as a consultant, or is it going to be run like we do the comprehensive plan, where they're going to have public hearings and have people come in and do little workshops, or what do you envision?
It's consultant-based, where the consultants will work with them to set up these individual meetings, depending on the focus group. One meeting, for example, will be education, one meeting will be civics, one meeting will be the business community. There'll be extensive outreach working with the consulting group to do that.
Okay. Councilman Wynn.
Thank you. So who's the consultant?
Wadley Dobbin Growth Tech.
Can you tell?
Sure. They were actually the firm that did the economic development plan and study for the city of Newark a few years ago. The Greater Newark Alliance worked on that report. And we liked, from a format standpoint, how they laid it out for Newark in terms of action steps, specific steps in terms of what local government can do in these initiatives. And, you know, we're going to direct their efforts in terms of what we would see in terms of target investment that works best for the county, what we can do programmatically to improve economic development efforts for Newcastle County.
How much was the contract for?
You approved for $49,500.
Mm-hmm. And what's the timeline going forward?
As I said, 6 months.
6 months. Yes. I'm sorry, I was zoned out again. I think that answers all my questions. Thanks.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Councilman Smile.
Will they be reporting to you or to community governing?
They're reporting to me, sir.
Okay, I was just curious. Taking over everything else.
Councilman Collins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the idea here would be for this consultant to develop a economic development plan.
Yes. Working in conjunction with us, obviously.
Do we have any sense of how the implementation of that plan will go?
Well, that's the purpose of the kickoff meeting. It'll go step by step how it's going to happen in terms of the outreach and the timing of the report, the scope of the report. It's a public
then event. But then after the fact, mm-hmm. Are we going to then sit down and talk about how we're going to implement this? Like, we're talking about rezonings, or the coordination
yes.
with the Department of Land Use,
yes.
proactive rezonings, that kind of thing?
Absolutely.
Is that we're heading towards?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. How did the Newark plan work out for them?
I think they're still in implementation stages. And understand, they had a different focus. They were focused on certain specific industries that they wanted to incentivize to come to Newark. Our focus is a little more holistic in terms of authority, in terms of incentivizing what the county can do for economic development. So it's a little slightly different focus. What we liked about Wadley Donovan Grove Tech was their format, their outreach, and the fact that how they included action plans and steps specific for that local government moving these things forward.
Any other questions from council? Councilwoman Diller.
Given for some of our districts, really the issue isn't industry, but as much underperforming centers, do they have experience dealing with that?
They had extensive experience in dealing with those issues in other jurisdictions and states and recommendations. And I'm happy to offer up samples of some of the research before they've done to what you're talking about. But all those issues we're going to look at from 10,000 feet for New Castle County, because they're all interconnected and they're all important.
Right.
And just housekeeping, President Bullock is joining us. Any other questions from council? Councilman Cartier.
Just a comment. I plan on being at the meeting. I've said this before, and I'm going to talk a little bit in the other agenda points where I can talk, but we've got to get very serious about economic development in this county. We are really in trouble, period. And
I agree.
I'm really glad that we approved the money for the consultant. We're going to have a meeting. We're going to start in a serious way being proactive to do something about economic development. And I know we have our state with its DITO office, but we can play a role too, and I'd like to see much more coordination between county government and DITO in the future as part of this. And I want to talk a little later in the meeting.
Councilman Smiley.
I couldn't agree more, Councilman Cartier, but as a reminder, this council had an opportunity to send the message to the business world that we had the authority to sponsor them to go to DITO to receive funds, and the majority of this council decided not to be proactive when it came to economic development. So let's see what we do going forward.
I
agree with you.
Part of my soapbox here, when I have constituents, when we're putting a Royal Farms on a corner or a CVS on another corner, and understanding that these are new businesses coming, maybe not the company, but new storefronts at least coming in. And then people come up to me and say, well, my housing value is going to drop if you put something like that anywhere near my house. From my perspective, we have not in 8 months, at least 10 months, we have not seen anything substantial come through our land use committee. Basically, we cancel about every other land use committee because there is nothing coming through the pipeline. Worst thing that can happen to our housing values is that there are no new businesses and that there's no new building in this area, because who's going to move here if we have nothing?
Right.
So if we as a council or as a public continue to say no to everything that comes across, whether it's a rezoning or something going to commercial, especially industrial, we find that we're looking at ST as the highest rising zoning category. We're looking at industrial as the fastest diminishing in zoning category within this county. And we get nothing if we don't have some industrial. We have got to carve out a place where we're comfortable with industrial. And I think that we all need to look through our districts and we need to think about where it would be best for some of these zoning categories to go in. because we can't just ignore the fact that we just don't want them in place. Councilman Retta.
Thank you. Under other, I'd like to bring something up. I don't know if you want me to do it first or you want to do the presentation first.
Well, we'd have to go out of order for you to do it first if you're going to do it under other, right?
Well,
we have still order,
and then you have presentation underneath it, so that's why I asked.
Oh, okay, because they had asked to come in under other.
Right.
Okay, but when we get to other, well, as soon as we're finished with this, then we can let you do it under other. Is that okay?
It's fine. It's okay. Up to you, your chair.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll just say, I'm confident that it will be. I know we talked about this before, that it's part of the economic development plan. We have to take into consideration and focus the existing businesses.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that's not, quite honestly, I don't think getting the attention. You know, this business wants to grow, but here's a new one. So, you know, we make it difficult for this business to be able to expand or grow. I mean, recently I spent a year working with a very big commercial establishment on Route 13 who did a multi-million dollar investment in upgrades, and I had to call the governor to get the medium strip cut. Couldn't get the grass cut out in front of the establishments, and it took a year, finally got a group plan. He put $35,000 on the table up front for a beautification. No one wanted to listen to him because this business is already here. He's not going to leave, so we're going to focus over here. I think we owe it to the businesses that have stayed, have been here as well, because I think prosperous, good-looking existing businesses is a big part of luring the new businesses to the area to go with that. So hopefully this will all come part and parcel together.
I couldn't agree more with what he just said, to be honest with you.
Councilman Tackett.
Did you have more?
I cut you off.
You paused. You can't pause here.
I'm satisfied with you.
Don't try to breathe because you'll be a...
Right. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Yeah, Marcus, obviously, you know, there's a lot of challenges you face, you know, or our state faces. We're a small state, and we just don't have the resources available, you know, as a lot of the larger states have, you know. You know, we have industrial land. I have actually quite a bit of industrial land in my district, you know, right along the freight lines, which is, you know, perfect. You know, bring them in on the freights, have the line there, and I have some industrial land that also backs the power lines, which, you know, when you're looking at trying to develop, you know, along power lines and stuff, you probably don't want as many houses in there as you do, sure, you know, industrial. And right off 95, too. So, I mean, there's some there. We do rezone it. But like, you know, the councilwoman said, you know, at some point, you know, we got to provide jobs. You know, we just can't continue to build homes because people can't buy the homes. So, you know, it's catch 22 and a double-edged sword, per se, whatever pun you want to use.
Fine,
but
yeah.
Right.
Yes.
And it is what it is. And the economic conditions tend to, you know, have a lot of the businesses not expanding anyhow, you know, so we are fortunate what we do get and what's happening. And it is a sad day whenever we lose anything.
And just what I was going to say is, I'm not going to promise this plan is going to address every concern. I mean, it's a baseline that we're going to create to how we move forward as Newcastle County. Now, the county, you know, we have some, you know, zoning authority, some other regulatory authority. It has to be, at the end of the day, and moving forward, a collaborative with other jurisdictions, the state primarily, in addressing some of these concerns, housing values, job creation, new business, existing business, because we're not going to address it just by Newcastle. It has to be collaborative with all these jurisdictions. But part of that is just reality of where we are as a state, where we are in terms of competition with other states, and where do we want to be in the next 5 to 10 years. And hopefully this plan is a springboard, at least from the county's perspective, in addressing these concerns.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
Any other comments from council? Comments from the public? Thank you so
much. Thank you for your time.
We'll see you Thursday. Under other, Councilman Retta.
Thank you. What I'd just like to report to you, today I had my third meeting with this group, and it has to do with, it was in the paper probably about a month ago, and Marcus was at the last meeting I was at with him, and So was the county exec and our land use general manager. It was the Cavalier Country Club, and what they're going to be doing is developing part of their land, and it's part of the program that the state wanted to do a few years ago. If anyone's familiar with the Cavalier Country Club or Cavalier Apartments, there's a road that goes down through there. It's called Country Club Drive. It's probably about 60 foot wide. What they want to do, they want to incorporate that all the way down into the area of the mall and back into Route 1 and 95 area. The group that's coming in to proposedly develop part of the nine holes of the Cavaliers is from Pennsylvania. And North America, they own probably about 20 casinos and different businesses, and they're a big group. And with this, they want to develop, which the county exec, myself, Marcus, and Eileen Fogarty talked about a mixed use, which would be commercial, residential. They're going to have an area down there. This is all proposal now. There's nothing yet started. Tomorrow I get a concept drawing of what they want to do. They're going to put some big commercials, not real big, but big commercials, which will be a draw. And then they're going to put smaller commercials, like little corner store type businesses within the community of the... It's going to be houses, apartments, and single family homes. It's going to be like a mixed area. And the bus route, according to the way DelDOT was talking to us at the one meeting, will go right down past and through this community, past the apartments, and down into the mall, and then into 95. So the project, one business alone will probably have about 500 employees. That's just one business and one store. So, and they pay, it's a retail store. They pay a decent wage. They got good benefits, and it's family owned. So with that, when other businesses see this store come, they want to be there with them because they're a big draw. So, you know, stay tuned. Marcus will be involved with the meetings that I have with them. And they want to go forward, and within 3 years, they want this project done. They don't want to waste no time with it. They want the businesses in there, and they want the homes built and the apartments built. And it's going to be affordable. They're going to build for the area for affordability. With that, the trees along the Country Club and Cavalier townhomes are going to be staying up. They're not taking any of them trees down. They're all going to be staying up. Most of the area that they're going to be developed is within where, if anyone's familiar with a golf course, where they play golf, where there's no trees, the trees are on the surrounding area. So that's basically how they're going to develop. They're going to keep as many things as they can for the area. The state was there today, two representatives from the state, which Karen Peters and Mike Barbieri, and when they saw and heard what was going on down there, they were well pleased with it, and they're willing to work with them. The next meeting is going to be with DelDOT, because the road that they're talking about that's a main road, and then there'll probably be about four or five other finger roads coming off it. So I just wanted to bring that up at this meeting to let you know that there is something in the works that within the next 3 years, if this thing goes through, I think you're going to see like a village effect down there. And it's going to be not the same, but similar to Claymont, because you got a different area, different people developing it.
Does this need a rezoning, or is it a by right?
No.
it's a rezoning.
Okay.
The no. One half.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. And so that'll be proactive.
Okay, so they be coming before us for that.
Yeah, so don't foot trap.
Councilman Sutter?
I just would take a moment to talk about some economic development as well. We all read about Corporation Service Company bringing more jobs, competing against another state. They're staying here. I'm going to be meeting with Mr. Burt, who's their CEO, to review the site and the site plans. And you know, it's just a positive. It'll be good-paying jobs. CCOBH President Bob Bellahore and I met with the Capana organization concerning the reutilization of the old Wanamaker's building for Insight that's coming in, and that's all positive as well.
I read that. Councilman Cardini?
So, a little bit of negative news on the economic development front. I'm glad somebody's got some positive news. You all read, I'm sure, that Claymont Steel, which has pretty much been open over 93 years, is going to go to closure on December 13th. It's close to 400 employees there. I got to tell you that this news has come kind of out of the wild blue yonder. It was acquired by Evraz, a multinational Russian-based steel company, for over $500 million in 2007. They put a large cap program into that plant. It looked better than it's looked in years. It seemed like they were doing well, but I guess they're not. And I don't know what the fate of that mill is going to be. My understanding is that it will be up for sale, but on December 13th, we got 400 people that are out of work. And this comes on top of, you know, the closure of the Sunoco refinery, which, you know, part of that plant is in Pennsylvania. Part of it is in Delaware. A lot of people don't really understand that. The oldest oil refinery in the United States, which had a devastating impact on my part of the Brandywine 100.
And General Chemical.
General Chemical before that. You know, all of the manufacturing continues to decline. That's the story. The one positive thing is that we are clear that the Sunoco refinery is going to be repurposed as a large natural gas port. It will be a giant player in the new natural gas economy, and I've said to folks around the table here, you know, in Delaware, we are next door to the Saudi Arabian natural gas. That's the state of Pennsylvania. And all that, you know, all the controversy associated with fracking, but the new natural gas economy is being born right now. We have to figure out a way to get on board that change and that new economic development. Sunoco will not employ the kind of workforce that it employed in the past as a refinery, but it will be repurposed. And that brings up the other issue, you know, repurposing old industrial sites. And I think we have major regulatory hurdles with the Coastal Zone Act and time clocks on, you know, industrial use rights, which are terminated over a period of years, as I understand, or a period of time if the site goes unused. I think all those issues should be looked at as part of this, you know, study that what are we going to do with these old industrial sites? How can we bring them back to life? Because the logic is compelling. You have all the infrastructure there. Usually you have your roads, sewer, electrical infrastructure, fuel infrastructure is all present on these old sites. And, you know, bringing them back to life to create new employment is going to be a big challenge in this county. Otherwise, you know, we're just going to be this giant Rust Belt county with no opportunity for folks. So, but I wanted to bring that to the table that, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, the steel mill in Claymont will be, you know, purchased and continued to be used. It is the largest recycler in the state. It's also the largest electrical user in the state. And it's played a critical role for employment for now nearly 100 years. And we hope that it will have a new owner and continue to operate.
We certainly hope so, and sooner rather than later. Councilman, oh.
Yeah.
You're here. Phil, Councilman Powers has joined us at the table. Did you have a question, or was it just a recognition?
Well, that was one of them. The other thing is, I guess a few months ago, about a month or so ago, Ruby and I went to Amazon in Middletown. They want to build another one, but I think the really drawback is not having enough people.
Not having enough people?
To man it. I mean, right
there?
Now, if you notice on the radio, they're still advertising trying to get enough people to run the plant that they have right now. If you watch how the shifts change, they have three cops they're paying from Middletown because there's just so much traffic going in and out of there. So I don't think anybody's really thought of it, and it's probably a little different for the area. But that plant right now is only two-thirds full. And there's a lot of area that's white space. When you worked in a plant, it used to be white space was area we could grow into on a set of plants. They're not quite the capacity, but they're looking for another site. They really like Delaware. Talking to one of the vice presidents, it's more the labor that they might have a problem drawing on. Mm-hmm.
Maybe. Are they hiring full-time or are they hiring part-time?
Full and part-time. They were supposed to, when they built it, within a year they were supposed to be to 800 jobs, maybe 1,200. They're over 1,600 permanent jobs. Then they've hired part-time. So if you build another plant, you're looking at another 1,600 to 2,000 mm-hmm. that are permanent, mm-hmm. along with the holiday, you know, between October and January.
Right. And they hire more.
But there's a lot more work in there than anybody expected.
Great. So. Any other comments from council?
It's Christmas.
Well, that's even more. That's why they got such a traffic problem. Fire. Mm-hmm. They do want to come back. It's assembly. It looks no different than when I went to Christ.
Yeah. Okay. We have a presentation. Mr. Victor Rosato asked if he could give a presentation to this committee on the state of the fast food workers and the fed fast food industry in New Castle County. Are you prepared at this point? Are you everybody?
We're ready to go.
Okay, sure. Yes.
Ezra's going to lead us off.
Okay.
So
great.
Thank you, everybody, for the opportunity to be here.
Yes. State your name for the record.
Yes.
Okay.
For the opportunity to be here today and for taking a little bit of your time. My name is Ezra Temko. I'm the Delaware organizer for the Delaware chapter of Americans for Democratic Action. We're a nonpartisan community advocacy group. And we're here to support fast food workers in Delaware who are part of a national movement to win fair wages. Delaware ADA, along with many community partners, supported fast food workers in northern New Castle County who participated in a nationwide strike on August 29th. We also held a press conference with workers on October 15th to release a new academic study that Victor is passing out now, Fast Food, Poverty, Wages, the Public Cost of Low-Wage Jobs in the Fast Food Industry. And we are honored to have Council President Bullock speak at that press conference in solidarity with the workers. As the movement and campaign continues to build and gain momentum, we are here today to explore the implications for this community of the fast food industry paying poverty-level wages to its employees. So I'd like to introduce Darlene Battle. She's the Executive Director of the Delaware Alliance for Community Advancement, and she's going to speak briefly about why we're here today with you.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
Yeah.
For my target. Okay. There are no advancements when corporations can...
Excuse me. Yes. Could you just state your name for the record before you speak?
Oh, I'm so sorry. Sure. My name is Darlene Battle. I'm the Executive Director for Delaware Alliance for Community Advancement.
Thank you.
Just got in from Dover, so I'm
trying. We're not in a hurry.
Okay. Okay. There could be no advancement when corporations can implement and get away with irresponsible businesses practices that inflicts poverty on workers and communities, and then lay the cost of these policies at the doorstep of taxpayers and citizens. Our burgeoning coalition is a movement of Delaware fast food workers, supporters from faith, labor, and community groups, who are fighting to raise wages and gain rights at work. It is part of the national movement of low-wage workers, fighting for a better future. When all Delawareans make enough to live instead of barely getting by, our communities and economy benefits. Our Delaware coalition joined the momentum of strikes and other low-wage workers' struggles to build community engagement. Hold corporations and other CEOs accountable and to raise wages so that Delaware can prosper. We are here today to hear. We are here today to hear directly from workers and an expert from the impact of fast food industry in our community. And we will urge the Newcastle County Council members to take action in support of the thousands of fast food service workers and their families throughout our county. Thank you.
Thank you, Darlene. So now we're going to dig into the meat of the matter. And so I'm going to introduce Jack Temple. He is a policy analyst with the National Employment Law Project and principal author of the recent report, Supersizing Public Costs. And he's going to share with you information about public costs attributable to the fast food industry paying their workers poverty level wages.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you, members of the Economic Development Subcommittee. For the record, my name is Jack Temple. As mentioned, I'm a policy analyst at the National Employment Law Project. We're a nonprofit research group based in D.C. and focusing on issues that concern low-wage and unemployed workers across the country. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning, this afternoon. My testimony, as mentioned, will focus on how rapidly growing industries such as fast food impose substantial costs to taxpayers through a business model of low wages, insufficient benefits, and limited work hours. This topic was the subject, as was mentioned, of two recent reports, one by economists at the University of California, Berkeley, which you have in your hands, and another by the National Employment Law Project, of which I was the principal author. The growth of low-wage jobs remains one of the most urgent issues facing state economies and the U.S. economy today. According to a 2012 report by the National Employment Law Project, middle-wage and high-wage occupations made up fully 79% of all job losses throughout the Great Recession. Yet nearly three out of every five jobs, or roughly 60%, of jobs created in the post-recession recovery were low-wage occupations. And so what we had was a very unbalanced period where middle and high-wage jobs were lost disproportionately throughout the recession, and low-wage jobs, chiefly in the service sector and represented most significantly by restaurant and retail occupations, made up the bulk of those that were created throughout the recovery. Moreover, the Bureau of Labor Statistics shows that low-wage jobs will make up the significant majority, fully 60%, of the occupations with the largest projected growth over the remainder of this decade. And so what these data confirm are that unless we take active steps to raise wages for workers across the country, and in states like Delaware, the lowest paid workers then, these low-wage jobs will continue to define the core of our economy. That'll fuel greater inequality and inhibit upward mobility for workers. Now, while low-paid workers face increasing economic security under insecurity under these conditions, the data confirm that the negative consequences of low-wage job growth ultimately affect the public as a whole as well. For example, when companies do not pay workers enough to afford basic necessities, then these workers must rely on public assistance in order to make ends meet. And as a result, low wages, as I mentioned, impose substantial costs on taxpayers every year. The fast food industry in particular stands out for its distinctly low wages, lack of full-time work hours, and almost non-existent benefits, all of which result in fast food workers being disproportionately reliant on public assistance relative even to workers in other low-wage industries. So just to consider the numbers, for core frontline fast food workers, and that refers to non-managerial workers who are employed at least 10 hours per week and at least 26 weeks per year. So in other words, what we would think of as the most sort of enduring segment of the fast food workforce. The median hourly wage for these workers across the country is just $8.69 per hour. In addition to receiving low wages, fast food workers are significantly less likely to receive health benefits from their employer. Specifically, only 13% of core frontline fast food workers receive health benefits from their employer. That's compared to 59% of workers across the board. And finally, limited work hours remain a predominant quality of work in the fast food industry. And this further limits the overall compensation of fast food workers. Fully 70% of core frontline fast food workers are employed less than 40 hours per week. In fact, the median core frontline fast food employee works just 30 hours per week. Now, this business model of low wages, insufficient benefits, and limited work hours means that a substantial share of fast food workers must rely on public assistance in order to make ends meet. And an analysis of census and administrative data finds that 52% of core frontline fast food workers rely on some form of public assistance to support themselves or their families. In other words, at 52%, public assistance is really the rule rather than the exception in the fast food industry. Fast food workers are more than twice as likely to rely on public assistance as compared to all other workers. Now, these figures refer strictly to rates of usage by fast food workers of four main public safety net programs, specifically Medicaid, Children's Health Insurance Program, Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, known as food stamps, and temporary assistance for needy families. Due to lack of readily available data, these figures do not take into account a broader range of public assistance from which many fast food workers would likely benefit, including subsidized child care, housing, school lunches. And so consequently, these figures remain conservative estimates that almost certainly understate the extent of participation in public safety net programs among fast food workers. And yet, even under conservative estimates, the data show that low-wage business models in the fast food industry translates to substantial costs to taxpayers every year. The combination of low wages, insufficient benefits, and limited work hours in the fast food industry as a whole costs taxpayers throughout the United States a total of $7 billion every year on average. Now, while the cost of low-wage fast food jobs is significant, it's important to note that these costs are not inevitable. Indeed, the data confirm that the top corporate fast food chains in the U.S. account for a substantial share of the public costs in the industry. And these very companies remain in strong financial condition and can afford to significantly improve compensation practices. I'm not sure, actually. I have slides, but I'm not sure. Oh, great. Thanks so much. Great. So here we have the top fast food companies in the U.S., as I mentioned, the leading top 10 chains. And next to them, the total average annual cost of public assistance provided to their employees across the country. So based on publicly available data, the National Employment Law Project estimates that the 10 largest fast food chains, which you see in front of you, cost taxpayers in the country an average of $3.8 billion every year. Notably, low-wage jobs at McDonald's alone cost taxpayers an estimated $1.2 billion per year, more than twice the cost of any other large fast food company. And so again, to reiterate, while the fast food industry as a whole costs taxpayers an average of $7 billion per year due to the low-wage jobs forcing workers in the industry to rely on public assistance, what we see are that these costs are overwhelmingly driven by the top chains, and that this is an industry that's overwhelmingly dominated by some of the leading companies. And yet, even as these companies shift substantial costs onto taxpayers, financial data for the top fast food chains indicate that these companies continue to earn strong profits today. I don't know if we can do the next slide. Next one, if there should be. Great, thank you. Great. The seven largest publicly traded fast food companies, which you see on that list, they earned a combined total of $7.4 billion in profits in fiscal year 2012. And these companies awarded their highest paid executives with $53 million in combined compensation. So what these data on profits and executive data confirm is that fast food companies really do have a choice. They can continue to earn substantial profits by paying poverty-level wages and shifting billions in costs onto taxpayers. Or these companies, by virtue of the substantial profits that we see they earn every year, could invest their profits in paying living wages. It'll benefit millions of low-paid workers in states across the country and boost the economy overall. What the data just emphasized show is that the picture that we see across the country really applies just as much in the state of Delaware as it does for the national averages. The median hourly wage for the 11,200 fast food workers in the state of Delaware equals just $8.57 per hour. Now, assuming that fast food workers in the state work consistent with the national average of 24 hours per week, then the average fast food worker in Delaware would make $206 per week, or translating to $10,695 per year. And by comparison, an adult with one child needs to make at least $21.84 an hour working full-time in the Wilmington area just to afford the basics, according to an economic model developed by Professor Amy Glassmeyer at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And so based on the experience of fast food workers in Delaware and elsewhere, the difference between a living wage and a poverty wage is often made up of public assistance programs. So what we see in the state are what we can expect to see as the trend across the board, which is that low-wage jobs with limited work hours and almost non-existent benefits are forcing workers in the state to rely on public assistance. These companies are shifting the costs onto the taxpayers. Until reforms are made to raise wages in the fast food industry, growing numbers of workers, including older and more skilled workers, will find themselves relying on low-wage jobs in order to make ends meet. And just to confirm, contrary to common misperception, fully 70% of fast food workers are adults over the age of 20. And census data show that 31% of fast food workers have at least some college education, and 26% have at least one child. And so to return to sort of what I began with, we have an economy where really low-wage jobs are beginning to make up the core of the labor market now. And as a result, we're seeing more workers, including adults, including those supporting families, and even including those with some advanced education, finding themselves with little choice but to rely on low-wage jobs in order to make ends meet. Now, that's obviously a growing problem for workers themselves and working families in states across the country, but it's also a problem for the public as a whole and increasingly a problem for the taxpayers, because the low-wage and limited benefit and limited hours business model that defines many low-wage industries, including fast food most notably, is based on a model where taxpayers are essentially picking up the cost between the poverty wage and a living wage that we should aspire to in this industry. So I want to thank you again for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have afterwards. Thank you.
Thanks. So we have a number of workers here today. One of them who could not make it is Ben Hunter. He's a Newcastle County resident who works at the Burger King on Concord Pike. He's actually working right now, so he could not make it, but we do have a statement that he prepared to hand out. Another worker who's here to speak is Candy Crippen. She's also a Newcastle County resident and works at the Wendy's on Concord Pike, and she's here to share her story.
Hi, my name is Candy Crippen. I work at Wendy's on 202 Concord Pike. I've been there for about 5 or 6 years. I still make $7.25 an hour. I have two children, a 16-year-old and an 8-year-old. Well, making ends meet, we very rarely do that. But to say we're surviving, as long as we have something to eat and, of course, clothes and stuff on our back, I say we survive. But it could be a lot easier and a lot better if we had more money for the work that we do. Working at Wendy's is not an easy job, as everybody might say, oh, that's easy. It sounds easy because everything is basic, but to have to incorporate everything that we do on a daily basis in there, it's not easy. And to keep it going, it's not easy at all. It's a lot of work on the body, the mind, and the soul. So if we could possibly make more than $7.25 an hour, it would be greatly appreciated, because some people go to work every day and still don't have a place to live because they only make $7.25 or $8.95, or, you know, it don't make enough to support an entire family. Not even a partial family, because I got a partial family, and I don't even make enough to support that. So, I mean, it would really help if we could fight, stand together, and make it work. It could be a lot better than $7.25 an hour, because I work really hard where I work at. I mean, I work every position in that store, and they can't compensate me for any of it. I mean, I stay late when they need me. I go in early when they need me. I fill in other places when they need me, but it don't help me any, you know? And I mean, sometimes there was a time when I went into Wendy's, just had a bad day altogether. I went in one morning to set up the store. It just seemed like everything was not working right. And along with that, most of the stuff in the store don't work right. So we have to make our own niches to make things work in that store for us sometimes, because a lot of the stuff that they have makes it harder to get it done in their timely fashion, you know? So sometimes we have to work together as a team to make their store work, but it don't help us in the long run. It's helping them, really. So it would just feel appreciated to just, you know, have more to work with and to more to support my family with, our families, because it's a lot of us here, a lot.
Councilman Smiley, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I have a question. I know, first, McDonald's and all wasn't even around when I started working. There was Geno's, and
yeah,
I went
that.
To work in a restaurant at 13, so I started there. But I a sister-in-law that worked in the McDonald's, and the, one of the problems that she had, and I'm just curious as to if it's still a prevalent problem, is there were times when she would show up for work maybe 10 or 15 minutes, and they'd make a determination, was it going to be busy?
Yeah,
and it actually cost her more to get to work than she earned during that time, because they would send them back home.
That happened to me maybe three or four times.
So that still does happen.
Yeah, if the labor is high and they don't need the employees that's on the schedule,
yeah,
they'll start sending them home gradually.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that happened to me one time where I went to work. I was on the schedule, and it was already more employees there, and they didn't need me because the business was high. So, yeah, they'll send you home.
Yeah. There were times that she didn't. It actually cost her more to go there and come back home than she made.
Yeah, really. That's a major problem, yes.
Councilman Weiner.
Thank you. This is a very important topic, and folks might think, well, why are you here before county government when obviously the state government and federal government set the wages? But I think it's very important that you're here. The 13 members of council come from very varied backgrounds, all sorts of jobs. I'm a political scientist by training. I'm an attorney. I worked my way through college and law school, working minimum wages at different restaurants and gas stations at 30th and Market and 20th and Market. But when I was getting paid $1.60 an hour, that was actually a lot more than you're getting paid right now, because I was working in the 60s, and it was a lot more money.
You're right.
And my parents went bankrupt, so, you know, I had to pay it for my own. But I'm not saying that to say, you know, I was disadvantaged. I felt that it was easier for me at that time than it is right now. There haven't been the adjustments for inflation. Even compared to the $1.60 an hour that I was making at minimum wage for those years. Now, the gentleman over here talked about proposing investment of profits into higher wages. We have a system that's driven by corporate shareholder profits. And the Congress, I think, would not be inclined to change that system. But there is, within the capitalistic system, an opportunity that could be brought about by a public-private partnership, and that's cooperative business, which works very well, where we, the workers, own the business. Not only do we get the wages, but we share in the corporate profits. And I think that would be one route that we could use in order to achieve our goal of of better wages, because ultimately we all end up paying a lot more than minimum wage for all the societal costs. I want to talk about one other thing that has been part of my mantra since I've been here for 18 years, and that's transportation, mass transit. Everyone's used to hearing me always say, with every project that comes up, is this transit oriented? Do people have to be prisoners of a single occupancy vehicle? Or are we planning this commercial, office, residential, recreational so people can take a transit or walk to where they live, shop, work, and play? And a lot of times, you know, over the last 18 years, people look at me and they sort of, like, why do I keep saying that? And that's because we need all sorts of workers. We need workers at every aspect of jobs. But unless we begin to realize that we were not planning during our love affair with automobiles over the last 60 years,
yeah,
our auto-dominated industry, for going back to what we did for thousands of years, walkable, transit-oriented villages, whether it was a stagecoach or a train, we are not going to be able to overcome these obstacles, and we have to.
You're right.
Thank you. That's all I wanted to say.
Council President Bullock.
I was happy to stand with this group, I believe, in October, the press conference, to support people over profits. Secondly, I have a question. Could you share with us the working conditions, how you treat it?
At my store?
Your store, any other group, members of the group that are here, how are you treated in the working conditions? You're at Wendy's, correct?
Yeah, Wendy's on 12. Well, my opinion, the way I'm treated at my store, I feel like we're treated like children. Like, the way they talk to us, the way they demand us to do things. And then when things don't get done her way, or you, quote-unquote, piss her off in a way, she'll cut your hours. I've been cut down all the way down to one day for, what, maybe 4 weeks straight. And that's her tactic to try to get you to quit, or, you know, give up your position, or argue and fuss so she can fire you, you know. But in my opinion, they treat us like children. In every aspect of the job.
Councilman Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I agree with the findings here from the National Employment Law Project. And I've seen this analysis here discussed, as a matter of fact, on Saturday. I was at the Grand Comedian, and she talked about using the same analysis with Walmart and the cost it is to all of us when you have the types of wages at fast food, Walmart, and I would imagine there are others who are in the same category, migrant workers, et cetera. Unfortunately, in our history as Americans, you know, a lot of folk have gotten filtered rich off the backs of labor of others. There's an ongoing debate about the disproportionate compensation between American CEOs as well as others. But I think for me to get move forward with this, if Mr. Temple could, and I appreciate the work that you've done wherever you went, but if you could also provide us with some recommendations for resolution that this body could adopt, and we can move forward to try to achieve some of the reforms that you would like to see happen. So I think you've done a very good job of outlining the problem here and the cost. But what do you recommend that we may be able to do as Newcastle County Government?
So I'd like to defer, actually, if I could.
Yeah. We actually have one more speaker, if possible, and then Darlene was going to talk about specifically what we would be asking this body to...
Okay, you'd like to go ahead with your next speaker?
Okay, I have one more. Yeah. I would like to talk about the food stamps and the government help that we get as fast food workers. Everybody that I work with, every female that I work with receives something from the government, whether it's cash assistance, food stamps, Medicaid, and it's like there's no other way around it. Well, Medicaid, of course, we don't get no kind of medical benefits, no dental or health benefits, but we have to pretty much take all of our earnings and everything to the government to get help. But what are we going to do when food stamps and Medicaid and everything is not there? Who's going to help us then? Like, we, after that, we have no other, nothing else to fall back on. We just struggle then.
Councilman Howard.
And if I may, that's a concern that we certainly have here. We've had these discussions with the government going to what they call sequestering, and I also recognize that the government has cut back on food stamps, the amount of money that's being spent on the federal level. It's not that there's not a concern and a care, but these are federal programs. They make those decisions in Washington. We have sent, I have authored letters to our congressional representation with regard to the sequestering that's going on now, where they stopped everything. And we were afraid it would also impact the issue that you brought forth, as well as affordable housing, and it continues to go on. So the reason for my question is that there are certain things that we as a county council can impact and do. There are other things that are better addressed at the federal level. There are certain things as wages that are addressed at the state level. So specifically, you spend a lot of time here, a lot of folk appear here today to express this concern, but if you narrow it down to what we can do to advance the reforms that we're mentioning, I think that would be very helpful to us, with the understanding that a lot of these programs, that most of the programs that actually are designed to help low-income folk in need, or in fact federal programs that are being cut.
Yeah.
What we have done as a county council, and some of my colleagues here who attend the National Association of Counties almost every single year, have fought very hard face-to-face on the front line to try to maintain community development block grant funds, which a lot of our monies that come to us from the federal government that we allocate to the kinds of services that you're concerned about. But it's an ongoing dialogue, it's an ongoing push, and quite frankly, it has been being cut for the last, I don't know how many years. Councilman Weiner, Councilman Cartier are always present at the NACO meetings, as they are called. I'm always present at the Congressional Black Caucus, just came back in September, to try to understand and better advance things on the local level. And that's what I would like to see happen. Is there something that we can do code-wide that we can implement to have impact on the lives of people, other than just talking about, you know, the challenges?
Thank you.
Yes.
Councilman Powers?
Thank you.
And I'll be real quick. The food stamp thing is part of the ag budget. It's one of the smallest budgets in the federal, of all the budgets. And it's always thinking it's being cut from farmers. But the majority of the ag budget is food stamps. And but everybody thinks, oh, let's cut the farmers. And really, they're cutting people that really need the food. And it's hard as a farmer to get that out to the public, that we are tied together. Literally, even in your business, we're tied together.
Yeah, we need food to produce.
You
Thank you. You want to proceed with your next speaker?
Thank you. And Victor's going to pass out Ben's testimony. Our next speaker is the Daisy Cruz. She's the director of the Mid-Atlantic District for SEIU Local 32BJ, and she's going to speak about how fast food corporations paying fair wages to our workers would benefit our community. And then again, Darlene will wrap up with kind of what our specific asks are of this body.
Thank you.
I thank you for your time, and I'll make it pretty simple. Yes. So my name is Daisy Cruz, and I'm the director of SEIU 32BJ, the Mid-Atlantic District. SEIU 32BJ represents 145,000 workers in 11 states and 10,000 in Delaware Valley. We represent office custodial employees in Wilmington and the surrounding Newcastle County. We believe that all workers deserve a living wage. We stand behind all low-wage workers, whether it's Wilmington janitors fighting for a fair contract or food workers organizing for $15 an hour in a union. In August, Wilmington fast food workers went on strike because they were tired. They are tired of struggling to get by. They walked off their jobs and took part in the largest fast food strike in our nation's history. We're here today because despite working hard at Burger King, Wendy, McDonald's, and fast food restaurants, a growing number of fast food workers are forced to rely on public assistance programs just to make ends meet. Fast food workers nationwide are paid so little that the public needs to provide assistance to make sure that workers can afford basic everyday needs. As Delaware's economy becomes increasingly service-based, It is now more important than ever that we take a hard look at the real cost of low wage. Nearly 30% of people in Wilmington live in poverty, a rate double the national average, according to the most recent available data from the U.S. Census Bureau. But that should come to no surprise when 17.2% of Delaware jobs are low wage. Delaware workers were earning less as of January 2012, on average, that they made 10 years ago. The median real household income in Delaware decreased almost $8,500 since 2000, and it's only slightly higher than it was in 1984, according to the census data from the U.S. Census Bureau. As poverty rates have skyrocketed, so have crime rates, homelessness, and public assistance rules. There's no doubt that poverty-like wages have devastated impact on our community. We know that good jobs provided by Chrysler and GM are not coming back anytime soon. But there is a lot that we can do together to turn the service jobs we do have into good jobs. Creating and maintaining good jobs in Wilmington is a powerful and proactive way to stop this race to the bottom. 32 BJ members know about the transformative power of raising wages. The current agreement for Wilmington cleaners provides almost $2 per hour in wage increases by 2015 and secures meaningful benefits such as employee health benefits and paid time off. When workers are paid a living wage, it provides a boost to local economies. One single contract alone that covers 600 Wilmington office cleaners will pump $4 million extra into the local economy over the next 4 years. If we see that significant of an economic benefit for office cleaners, can you just imagine the benefit to the local economy if 11,000 fast food workers earned a living wage? The good news is that we have the ability to change this broken system. We're calling on council to take a hard look at the impact that low-wage jobs have on the Newcastle County and work with the community to turn these jobs into good, family-sustaining jobs. I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, to answer your question, I would ask. We asked Newcastle County Council to send a letter or pass a resolution to the CEOs of those fast food companies demanding that they pay a living wage and respect workers' rights to organize. We asked that Newcastle County Councilor request relevant state agencies to investigate and release data and information to determine the cost to the state of fast food business model to citizens and taxpayers. Lastly, we ask that Newcastle County Council explore direct action that County Council can take to directly support workers in their call for $15 an hour. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any other comments from council? Councilman Weiner?
Thanks. Who's the gentleman over here?
Jack Temple.
Jack Temple. Jack, I listened very carefully to the ask, and it's a fair ask, but I want to ask back to you. What about a strategy of public-private partnership to encourage cooperatives?
Thank you, Councilman. I'm Jack Temple at National Employment Law Project. To be honest, I have to admit I'm not an expert on that model. I think, as part of the ask, I do think sort of exploring a range of options would be a great opportunity. I think that would certainly be a great one to consider.
Right, because the pushback's going to be from the private sector is the way that our system's set up. Shareholder profit drives it. So we need a multiple strategy set, and that's got to include cooperatives as well. This is not inventing a new wheel.
Great. I appreciate the thought. Right.
Council President Bullock?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Darlene, could you provide that to the council members in writing specifically?
Yes,
ma'am.
Councilman Hollins?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank Ms. Battle for her response. And I'm just wondering if Mr. Temple had anything to add to the recommendations that was made by Ms. Battle, that is to demand
the CEOs of these various corporations to increase the waste. I can tell you about how far that's going to go. And secondly, to contact the state agencies, which I believe would be better done by state legislators, whether they be senators or state representatives. Oftentimes, and we make suggestions to the Delaware General Assembly, the members of the Delaware General Assembly gets offended because they assume that we're stepping outside of our boundaries. And I just think that there are certain things that I really think that we need to have a very honest and serious discussion around this if we're going to move forward. Otherwise, it's a waste of everybody's time here. There are certain realities in place that we need to acknowledge at the beginning of the debate. And that's the only thing I would request. If there's something that we can realistically do, I think that probably most council members will sign up on the resolution. But if we were to be real honest with the private sector, we have no real influence to say to DuPont or Burger King how to set their wages. And that's, I'm looking for something that we can really feel, I can feel that, okay, this is going to make a difference. Or this is just an exercise for someone to put on their brochure that, you know, I signed up on a resolution to help someone. This resolution has no real impact on nobody. So I think that's where I am, and that's where I would like to see us start with those kind of recommendations that are real recommendations that can move the ball down the road.
Councilman Cartier?
I have three comments or questions. Number one, you know, I found all the testimony very compelling, and there's no question that low wages in the fast food industry are a big problem for everybody concerned. And I think politics is waged on a level of symbols and, you know, actions. It's not only an arena where just practical reality just applies. I found all of the asks made by you folks to be things that I think are pretty reasonable, and I'd sign on board anytime. And I think, but in a real core practical fashion, you know, your state government can set minimum wages. And your state government does set a minimum wage. And I think the state government minimum wage is higher than federal minimum wage, if I'm correct about that. Mm-hmm. So you always need to keep that in mind in your work forward. I'm happy as a sitting member of County Council to lend my support to your call for higher wages. But the state government, you know, they can set higher minimum wages. That's a political decision that they make, whether to act on that or not. I can tell you that also speaking for the, you know, region of the county that I represent in Brandywine 100, I have a very good working relationship with all my state legislators there. I'd be happy to advocate on your behalf for raising the state minimum wage and maybe embarrassing them into advocating for that as well. Whatever I can do in that score, you know, I'm willing to do that. You've got a lot of hard work ahead of you, but I think you've got a good case to make, especially for those who are concerned about the public sector and its expenditures, about how, you know, in fact, the public sector subsidizes low wages in the fast food industry, makes it possible for that workforce to function. I think that's a very compelling argument to make, even to people who are on the more conservative side of the political spectrum.
Thank you. And I could just to kind of tag on to that, I think that many times when the General Assembly looks at setting minimum wage, and I think that Councilman Cartier is correct that at this point Delaware's minimum wage is higher than the federal standard.
Delaware's $7.25, which is federal. There's a bill, Senate Bill 6, that would raise it $1 above the
minimum. Okay. But the other thing I think to watch when you're talking to them is that when they look at exemptions, and sometimes, you know, like restaurant workers, they will exempt out because they have tips. I mean, make sure that you're not part of that exemption, because fast food workers don't necessarily get tips. It's not part of how that's run. So I think there are a couple of different ways to look at this, but I believe that the General Assembly is at the more local level, I mean, local for Delaware, the General Assembly is probably the place to start looking and asking, not that we individually or as a whole wouldn't consider, you know, asking, making an ask for you, but I think that those are some of the things that you need to look at. Councilman Powers, and then Councilman Howell.
Just a question. I mean, I know they've been working on raising the minimum wage on the state level. Have you shown them what it's costing us anyway? The same presentation that you've just given us.
Not the same presentation. Some of the legislators are aware of kind of this in the study, and it's been shared with them, but we haven't made the same presentation.
Yeah, you may need to meet with them individually and start. It might be a long way to go, but I mean, that it really isn't saving any money. One way or the other, somebody's paying for it.
Councilman Hollins.
I was going to basically say that it's Senator Bobby Marshall who's advancing the minimum wage in Dover. He's a Wilmington senator, and I think it would behoove all the people here to get behind Senator Marshall to help him have success in Dover, and that would be a beginning. And it's those kinds of issues that I'm more focused on, you know, something that we can really do here as a county government to advance the concerns of the underpaid people that are in the room tonight.
Any other questions from council? Any comments from the public? Yes.
Thank you again, everybody, for the opportunity to have this time and to share with you. And we really would appreciate, I'll send out those asks, but the support via letter or resolution, as well as for us to find out more Delaware and Newcastle County specific data from state agencies. I would also just add, definitely, I mean, I know my organization supports Senate Bill 6, which is the minimum wage bill, but there have been communities, local jurisdictions that have done something. I think Seattle, for example, has passed industry-specific wage increases on the local level as opposed to state level. And I don't know the specifics of Newcastle County law, but we appreciate the opportunity to speak today, and thanks for all the support. The comments we heard today.
We don't have that jurisdiction.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you for coming forward.
Thank you. Mr. Guy?
Yes, my name's Samuel Guy. I'm with the executive office, Tom Gordon's county exec. And I just wanted to say to the people that came here today, the county executive has been paying attention to the issues that you all have been raising, and they concern him as well as the legislative branch of government. And we want to encourage you to keep doing what you're doing, because there's more people that are hurting than are doing well. So you really have the power. You just haven't figured out how to exercise it yet. But you will if you just keep doing what you're doing. So, and your data, Mr. Temple, that's straight corporate welfare. Their workers here are getting subsidized by the government, which is the taxpayer money. And whoever it was that suggested that you get that message out to the public and to the people, because people have a problem subsidizing and investing in you as workers to move up on your job, but yet they'll subsidize corporate profit. So please do that education. Whoever said that, do what they said. Educate people about that.
Councilman Smiley.
I just think, you know, as someone who did organizing, fought for the higher, better wage, better working conditions, I applaud your efforts. And, well, not one to hold my tongue. I sit here somewhat frustrated because I see you fighting with multinational companies to try to get a decent wage for both your members and non-members. At the same time, I sit here and watch a company like Bloom Energy come in, and we automatically get taxed to help subsidize their pay. So where's the fairness in that? You know, where is the fairness in that? We're subsidizing the employees of these fast food companies through Medicaid, food stamps, federal programs. We're subsidizing Bloom Energy through our monthly power bills. We're subsidizing all over. So I just say, you know, I know how frustrating it is. Been there, did that, still feel it.
So I applaud all your efforts, you, your members, your non-members, and everybody out there, and I wish you luck.
Any other public comment? Councilman Powers.
I'll be real quick. Your testimony from Ben Hunter, I'm just, if he was from Middletown baling hay on a pig farm, he may have worked for me that long ago. And I'm not, but it wasn't anything bad. He just, he liked how much money he made.
$7.35
But I'm just, if I had seen him, I may remember. It's been a long time.
Any other comments? Mr. Rosado, thank you so much
for
the presentation today.
Thank you so much.
Any other comments? Motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Aye.
Aye.
You, we.